to his coat pockets. He loved that kind of stuff. But he'd need 100 more coats to fit it all. Looking around, he could almost imagine he was back in his mom's machine shop. Not the weapons, maybe, but the tools, the piles of scrap, the smell of grease and metal and hot engines. She would have loved this place. He pushed that thought away. He didn't like painful memories. Keep moving. That was his motto. Don't dwell on things. Don't stay in one place too long. It was the only way to stay ahead of the sadness. He picked a long implement from the wall.
A weed whacker? What's the god of fire want with a weed whacker?
A voice in the shadow said,
You'd be surprised.
At the back of the room, one of the bunk beds was occupied. A curtain of dark camouflage material retracted, and Leo could see the guy who'd been invisible a second before. It was hard to tell much about him because he was covered in a body cast. His head was wrapped in gauze except for his face, which was puffy and bruised. He looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy after a beatdown.
I'm Jake Mason, the guy said. I'd shake your hand, but...
Yeah, Leo said. Don't get up.
The guy cracked a smile, then winced like it hurt to move his face. Leo wondered what had happened to him, but he was afraid to ask.
Welcome to Cabin 9, Jake said. Been almost a year since we had any new kids. I'm head counselor for now.
For now? Leo asked.
Will Solace cleared his throat. So where is everybody, Jake?
Down at the forges, Jake said wistfully. They're working on, you know, that problem.
Oh.
Will changed the subject.
So, you got a spare bed for Leo?
Jake studied Leo, sizing him up.
You believe in curses, Leo? Or ghosts?
I just saw my evil babysitter Tia Kaida, Leo thought. She's got to be dead after all these years, and I can't go a day without remembering my mom in that machine shop fire. Don't talk to me about ghosts, Doughboy. But aloud he said,
Ghosts? Nah, I'm cool. The storm spirit chucked me down the Grand Canyon this morning, but you know, all in a day's work, right?
Jake nodded.
That's good, because I'll give you the best bed in the cabin, Beckendorf's.
Whoa, Jake, Will said. You sure? Jake called out,
Bunk 1A, please.
The whole cabin rumbled. A circular section of the floor spiraled open like a camera lens, and a full-size bed popped up. The bronze frame had a built-in game station at the footboard, a stereo system in the headboard, a glass door refrigerator mounted into the base, and a whole bunch of control panels running down the side. Leo jumped right in and lay back with arms behind his head.
I can handle this.
It retracts into a private room below, Jake said.
Oh, heck yes, Leo said. See y'all, I'll be down in the Leo cave. Which button do I press?
Hold on, Will Solace protested. You guys have private underground rooms? Jake probably would have smiled if it didn't hurt so much.
We got lots of secrets, Will. You Apollo guys can't have all the fun. Our campers have been excavating the tunnel system under Cabin 9 for almost a century. We still haven't found the end. Anyway, Leo, if you don't mind sleeping in a dead man's bed, it's yours.
Suddenly, Leo didn't feel like kicking back. He sat up, careful not to touch any of the buttons.
The counselor who died? This was his bed?
Yeah, Jake said. Charles Beckendorf.
Leo imagined saw blades coming through the mattress, or maybe a grenade sewn inside the pillows.
He didn't, like, die in this bed, did he?
No, Jake said. In the Titan War last summer.
The Titan War, Leo repeated, which has nothing to do with this very fine bed.
The Titans, Will said, like Leo was an idiot.
The big powerful guys that ruled the world before the gods, they tried to make a comeback last summer. Their leader, Kronos, built a new palace on top of Mount Tam in California. Their armies came to New York and almost destroyed Mount Olympus. A lot of demigods died trying to stop them.
I'm guessing this wasn't on the news?
Leo said. It seemed like a fair question, but Will shook his head in disbelief. You didn't hear about Mount St. Helens erupting? Or the freak storms across the country? Or that building collapsing in St. Louis? Leo shrugged. Last summer, he'd been on the run from another foster home. Then a truancy officer caught him in New Mexico, and the court sentenced him to the nearest correctional facility, the Wilderness School.
Guess I was busy.
Doesn't matter, Jake said. You were lucky to miss it. The thing is, Beckendorf was one of the first casualties, and ever since then...
Your cabin's been cursed, Leo guessed.
Jake didn't answer. Then again, the dude was in a body cast. That was an answer. Leo started noticing little things that he hadn't seen before. An explosion mark on the wall. A stain on the floor that might have been oil or blood. Broken swords and smashed machines kicked into the corners of the room, maybe out of frustration. The place did feel unlucky. Jake sighed half-heartedly.
Well, I should get some sleep. I hope you like it here, Leo. It used to be really nice.
He closed his eyes, and the camouflage curtain drew itself across the bed.
Come on, Leo, Will said. I'll take you to the forges.
As they were leaving, Leo looked back at his new bed, and he could almost imagine a dead counselor sitting there. Another ghost who wasn't going to leave Leo alone. Chapter 6 Leo.
How did he die? Leo asked. I mean Beckendorf.
Will Solace trudged ahead.
Explosion. Beckendorf and Percy Jackson blew up a cruise ship full of monsters. Beckendorf didn't make it out.
There was that name again. Percy Jackson, Annabeth's missing boyfriend. That guy must have been into everything around here, Leo thought.
So Beckendorf was pretty popular? Leo asked. I mean, before he blew up?
He was awesome, Will agreed. It was hard on the whole camp when he died. Jake, he became head counselor in the middle of the war, same as I did, actually. Jake did his best, but he never wanted to be leader. He just likes building stuff. Then after the war, things started to go wrong. Cabin 9's chariots blew up. Their automatons went haywire. Their inventions started to malfunction. It was like a curse, and eventually people started calling it that. The curse of Cabin 9. Then Jake had his accident.
Which had something to do with the problem he mentioned, Leo guessed.
They're working on it, Will said without enthusiasm. And here we are.
The forge looked like a steam-powered locomotive had smashed into the Greek Parthenon, and they had fused together. White marble columns lined the soot-stained walls. Chimneys pumped smoke over an elaborate gable carved with a bunch of gods and monsters. The building sat at the edge of a stream, with several water wheels turning a series of bronze gears. Leo heard machinery grinding inside, fires roaring, and hammers ringing on anvils. They stepped through the doorway, and a dozen guys and girls who'd been working on various projects all froze. The noise died down to the roar of the forge and the click, click, click of gears and levers.
Sup, guys? Will said. This is your new brother, Leo, what's your last name?
Valdez.
Leo looked around at the other campers. Was he really related to all of them? His cousins came from some big families, but he'd always just had his mom until she died. Kids came up and started shaking hands and introducing themselves. Their names blurred together, Shane, Christopher, Nyssa, Harley. Yeah, like the motorcycle. Leo knew he'd never keep everybody straight. Too many of them. Too overwhelming. None of them looked like the others. All different face types, skin tone, hair color, height. You'd never think, hey look, it's the Hephaestus bunch. But they all had powerful hands, rough with calluses and stained with engine grease. Even little Harley, who couldn't have been more than 8, looked like he could go 6 rounds with Chuck Norris without breaking a sweat. And all the kids shared a sad kind of seriousness. Their shoulders slumped like life had beaten them down pretty hard. Several looked like they'd been physically beaten up, too. Leo counted 2 arm slings, 1 pair of crutches, an eye patch, 6 ace bandages, and about 7,000 band-aids.
"Well, all right," Leo said. "I hear this is the party cabin."
Nobody laughed. They all just stared at him. Will Solis patted Leo's shoulder.
"I'll leave you guys to get acquainted. Somebody show Leo to dinner when it's time."
"I got it,"
one of the girls said. Nyssa, Leo remembered. She wore camo pants, a tank top that showed off her buff arms, and a red bandana over a mop of dark hair. Except for the smiley face band-aid on her chin, she looked like one of those female action heroes. Like any second she was going to grab a machine gun and start mowing down evil aliens.
"Cool," Leo said. "I always wanted a sister who could beat me up."
Nyssa didn't smile.
"Come on, Joker boy. I'll show you around."
Leo was no stranger to workshops. He'd grown up around grease monkeys and power tools. His mom used to joke that his first pacifier was a lug wrench. But he'd never seen any place like the Camp Forge. One guy was working on a battle axe. He kept testing the blade on a slab of concrete. Each time he swung, the axe cut into the slab like it was warm cheese. But the guy looked unsatisfied and went back to honing the edge.
"What's he planning to kill with that thing?" Leo asked Nyssa. "A battleship? You never know, even with celestial bronze." "That's the metal?"
She nodded.
"Mined from Mount Olympus itself. Extremely rare. Anyway, it usually disintegrates monsters on contact, but big powerful ones have notoriously tough hides. Drakens, for instance." "You mean dragons?" "Similar species. You'll learn the difference in monster fighting class." "Monster fighting class?" "Yeah, I already got my black belt in that."
She didn't crack a smile. Leo hoped she wasn't this serious all the time. His dad's side of the family had to have some sense of humor, right? They passed a couple of guys making a bronze wind-up toy. At least that's what it looked like. It was a 6-inch tall centaur, half man, half horse, armed with a miniature bow. One of the campers cranked the centaur's tail and it whirred to life. It galloped across the table yelling, "Die, mosquito! Die, mosquito!" and shooting everything in sight. Apparently, this had happened before, because everybody knew to hit the floor except Leo. 6 needle-sized arrows embedded themselves in his shirt before a camper grabbed a hammer and smashed the centaur to pieces.
"Stupid curse!"
The camper waved his hammer at the sky.
"I just want a magic bug killer. Is that too much to ask?"
"Ouch," Leo said.
Nyssa pulled the needles out of his shirt.
You're fine. Let's move on before they rebuild it."
Leo rubbed his chest as they walked.
"That sort of thing happened a lot." "Lately," Nyssa said, "everything we build turns to junk." "The curse?"
Nyssa frowned.
"I don't believe in curses. But something's wrong. And if we don't figure out the dragon problem, it's gonna get even worse." "The dragon problem?"
Leo hoped she was talking about a miniature dragon, maybe one that killed cockroaches. But he got the feeling he wasn't going to be so lucky. Nyssa took him over to a big wall map that a couple of girls were studying. The map showed the camp. A semicircle of land with Long Island Sound on the north shore. The woods to the west, the cabins to the east, and a ring of hills to the south. It's got to be in the hills, the first girl said.
We looked in the hills, the second argued. The woods are a better hiding place.
But we already set traps.
Hold up, Leo said. You guys lost a dragon? A real, full-sized dragon.
It's a bronze dragon, Nissa said. But yes, it's a life-size automaton. Hephaestus' cabin built it years ago. Then it was lost in the woods until a few summers back, when Beckendorf found it in pieces and rebuilt it. It's been helping protect the camp, but, it's a little unpredictable.
Unpredictable? Leo said.
It goes haywire and smashes down cabins, sets people on fire, tries to eat the satyrs.
That's pretty unpredictable.
Nissa nodded. Beckendorf was the only one who could control it. Then he died, and the dragon just got worse and worse. Finally it went berserk and ran off. Occasionally it shows up, demolishes something, and runs away again. Everyone expects us to find it and destroy it.
Destroy it?
Leo was appalled.
You've got a life-size bronze dragon and you want to destroy it?
It breathes fire, Nissa explained. It's deadly and out of control.
But it's a dragon! Dude, that's so awesome! Can't you try talking to it, controlling it?
We tried. Jake Mason tried. You saw how well that worked.
Leo thought about Jake wrapped in a body cast, lying alone on his bunk.
Still.
There's no other option.
Nissa turned to the other girls.
Let's try more traps in the woods. Here, here, and here. Bait them with 30-weight motor oil.
The dragon drinks that? Leo asked.
Yeah.
Nissa sighed regretfully.
He used to like it with a little Tabasco sauce, right before bed. If he springs a trap, we can come in with acid sprayers. Should melt through his hide. Then we get metal cutters and finish the job.
They all looked sad. Leo realized they didn't want to kill the dragon any more than he did.
Guys, he said, there has to be another way.
Nissa looked doubtful, but a few other campers stopped what they were working on and drifted over to hear the conversation.
Like what? One asked. The thing breathes fire. We can't even get close.
Fire, Leo thought.
Oh, man. The things he could tell them about fire.
But he had to be careful, even if these were his brothers and sisters. Especially if he had to live with them.
Well, he hesitated. Hephaestus is the god of fire, right? So don't any of you have, like, fire resistance or something?
Nobody acted as if it was a crazy question, which was a relief, but Nissa shook her head gravely.
That's a Cyclops ability, Leo. Demigod children of Hephaestus? We're just good with our hands. We're builders, craftsmen, weaponsmiths, stuff like that.
Leo's shoulders slumped.
Oh.
A guy in the back said, Well, a long time ago.
Yeah, okay, Nissa conceded. A long time ago, some children of Hephaestus were born with power over fire. But that ability was very, very rare, and always dangerous. No demigod like that has been born in centuries. The last one...
She looked at one of the other kids for help.
1666, the girl offered. Guy named Thomas Fainer. He started the Great Fire of London, destroyed most of the city.
Right, Nissa said. When a child of Hephaestus like that appears, it usually means something catastrophic is about to happen, and we don't need any more catastrophes.
Leo tried to keep his face clear of emotion, which wasn't his strong suit.
I guess I see your point. Too bad, though. If you could resist flames, you could get close to the dragon.
Then it would kill you with its claws and fangs, Nissa said. Or simply step on you. No, we've got to destroy it. Trust me, if anyone could figure out another answer...
She didn't finish. But Leo got the message. This was the cabin's big test. If they could do something only Beckendorf could do, if they could subdue the dragon without killing it, then maybe their curse would be lifted. But they were stumped for ideas. Any camper who figured out how would be a hero. A conch horn blew in the distance. Campers started putting up their tools and projects. Leo hadn't realized it was getting so late, but he looked through the windows and saw the sun going down. His ADHD did that to him sometimes. If he was bored, a 50-minute class seemed like 6 hours. If he was interested in something, like touring a demigod camp, hours slipped away, and bam, the day was over.
"Dinner," Nissa said. "Come on, Leo." "Up at the pavilion, right?" he asked.
She nodded.
"You guys go ahead," Leo said. "Can you give me a second?"
Nissa hesitated. Then her expression softened.
"Sure, it's a lot to process. I remember my first day. Come up when you're ready. Just don't touch anything. Almost every project in here can kill you if you're not careful."
"No touching," Leo promised.
His cabin mates filed out of the forge. Soon Leo was alone with the sounds of the bellows, the water wheels, and small machines clicking and whirring. He stared at the map of camp. The locations where his newfound siblings were going to put traps to catch a dragon. It was wrong. Plain wrong. Very rare, he thought. And always dangerous. He held out his hand and studied his fingers. They were long and thin, not calloused like the other Hephaestus campers. Leo had never been the biggest or the strongest kid. He'd survived in tough neighborhoods, tough schools, tough foster homes by using his wits. He was the class clown, the court jester, because he'd learned early that if you cracked jokes and pretended you weren't scared, you usually didn't get beat up. Even the baddest gangster kids would tolerate you, keep you around for laughs. Plus, humor was a good way to hide the pain. And if that didn't work, there was always Plan B. Run away. Over and over. There was a Plan C, but he'd promised himself never to use it again. He felt an urge to try it now. Something he hadn't done since the accident, since his mom's death. He extended his fingers and felt them tingle, like they were waking up, pins and needles. Then flames flickered to life, curls of red-hot fire dancing across his palm. Chapter 7. Jason. As soon as Jason saw the house, he knew he was a dead man.
"Here we are," Drew said cheerfully. "The big house. Camp headquarters."
It didn't look threatening, just a four-story manor painted baby blue with white trim. The wraparound porch had lounge chairs, a card table, and an empty wheelchair. Wind chimes shaped like nymphs turned into trees as they spun. Jason could imagine old people coming here for summer vacation, sitting on the porch and sipping prune juice while they watched the sunset. Still, the windows seemed to glare down at him like angry eyes. The wide-open doorway looked ready to swallow him. On the highest gable, a bronze eagle weather vane spun in the wind and pointed straight in his direction, as if telling him to turn around. Every molecule in Jason's body told him he was on enemy ground. "I am not supposed to be here," he said. Drew circled her arm through his.
"Oh, please. You're perfect here, sweetie. Believe me, I've seen a lot of heroes."
Drew smelled like Christmas, a strange combination of pine and nutmeg. Jason wondered if she always smelled like that, or if it was some kind of special perfume for the holidays. Her pink eyeliner was really distracting. Every time she blinked, he felt compelled to look at her. Maybe that was the point, to show off her warm brown eyes. She was pretty,
no doubt about that. But she made Jason feel uncomfortable. He slipped his arm away as gently as he could.
Look, I appreciate...
Is it that girl? Drew pouted.
Oh, please tell me you are not dating the dumpster queen.
You mean Piper? Jason wasn't sure how to answer. He didn't think he'd ever seen Piper before today, but he felt strangely guilty about it. He knew he shouldn't be in this place. He shouldn't befriend these people, and certainly he shouldn't date one of them. Still, Piper had been holding his hand when he woke up on that bus. She believed she was his girlfriend. She'd been brave on the skywalk, fighting those venti, and when Jason had caught her in midair and they'd held each other face to face, he couldn't pretend he wasn't a little tempted to kiss her. But that wasn't right. He didn't even know his own story. He couldn't play with her emotions like that.
Drew rolled her eyes.
Let me help you decide, sweetie. You can do better.
A guy with your looks and obvious talent? She wasn't looking at him, though. She was staring at a spot right above his head.
You're waiting for a sign, he guessed. Like what popped over Leo's head.
What?
No.
Well, yes. I mean, from what I heard, you're pretty powerful, right? You're going to be important at camp, so I figure your parent will claim you right away, and I'd love to see that. I want to be with you every step of the way.
So is your dad or mom the god? Please tell me it's not your mom. I would hate it if you were an Aphrodite kid.
Why? Then you'd be my half-brother, silly. You can't date somebody from your own cabin. Yuck.
But aren't all the gods related? Jason asked. So isn't everyone here your cousin or something?
Aren't you cute? Sweetie, the godly side of your family doesn't count except for your parent. So anybody from another cabin, they're fair game. So who's your godly parent? Mom or dad?
As usual, Jason didn't have an answer. He looked up, but no glowing sign popped above his head. At the top of the big house, the weather vane was still pointing his direction, that bronze eagle glaring as if to say, "Turn around, kid, while you still can." Then he heard footsteps on the front porch. No, not footsteps. Hooves.
"Chiron!" Drew called. "This is Jason. He's totally awesome."
Jason backed up so fast he almost tripped. Rounding the corner of the porch was a man on horseback. Except he wasn't on horseback. He was part of the horse. From the waist up, he was human, with curly brown hair and a well-trimmed beard. He wore a t-shirt that said "World's Best Centaur," and had a quiver and bow strapped to his back. His head was so high up, he had to duck to avoid the porch lights, because from the waist down, he was a white stallion. Chiron started to smile at Jason. Then the color drained from his face.
"Ew!"
The centaur's eyes flared like a cornered animal's.
"You should be dead."
Chiron ordered Jason, well, invited, but it sounded like an order, to come inside the house. He told Drew to go back to her cabin, which Drew didn't look happy about. The centaur trotted over to the empty wheelchair on the porch. He slipped off his quiver and bow and backed up to the chair, which opened like a magician's box. Chiron gingerly stepped into it with his back legs and began scrunching himself into a space that should have been much too small. Jason imagined a truck's reversing noises. Beep, 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 as the centaur's lower half disappeared and the chair folded up, popping out a set of fake human legs covered in a blanket. So Chiron appeared to be a regular mortal guy in a wheelchair.
"Follow me," he ordered. "We have lemonade."
The living room looked like it had been swallowed by a rainforest.
Grapevines curved up the walls and across the ceiling, which Jason found a little strange. He didn't think plants grew like that inside, especially in the winter, but these were leafy green and bursting with bunches of red grapes. Leather couches faced a stone fireplace with a crackling fire. Wedged in one corner, an old-style Pac-Man arcade game beeped and blinked. Mounted on the walls was an assortment of masks, smiley, frowny, Greek theater types, feathered Mardi Gras masks, Venetian carnival masks with big, beak-like noses, carved wooden masks from Africa. Grapevines grew through their mouths so they seemed to have leafy tongues. Some had red grapes bulging through their eye holes. But the weirdest thing was the stuffed leopard's head above the fireplace. It looked so real, its eyes seemed to follow Jason. Then it snarled, and Jason nearly leapt out of his skin.
"Now, Seymour," Chiron chided. "Jason is a friend. Behave yourself."
"That thing is alive," Jason said.
Chiron rummaged through the side pocket of his wheelchair and brought out a package of snossages. He threw one to the leopard, who snapped it up and licked his lips.
"You must excuse the decor," Chiron said. "All this was a parting gift from our old director before he was recalled to Mount Olympus. He thought it would help us to remember him. Mr. D has a strange sense of humor."
"Mr. D," Jason said. "Dionysus?"
"Mm-hmm."
Chiron poured lemonade, though his hands were trembling a little.
"As for Seymour, well, Mr. D liberated him from a Long Island garage sale. The leopard is Mr. D's sacred animal, you see, and Mr. D was appalled that someone would stuff such a noble creature. He decided to grant it life, on the assumption that life as a mounted head was better than no life at all. I must say it's a kinder fate than Seymour's previous owner got."
Seymour bared his fangs and sniffed the air, as if hunting for more snossages. "If he's only a head," Jason said, "where does the food go when he eats?"
"Better not to ask," Chiron said. "Please, sit."
Jason took some lemonade, though his stomach was fluttering. Chiron sat back in his wheelchair and tried for a smile, but Jason could tell it was forced. The old man's eyes were as deep and dark as Wells.
"So, Jason," he said, "would you mind telling me, where you're from?"
"I wish I knew." Jason told him the whole story, from waking up on the bus to crash landing at Camp Half-Blood. He didn't see any point in hiding the details, and Chiron was a good listener. He didn't react to the story, other than to nod encouragingly for more. When Jason was done, the old man sipped his lemonade.
"I see," Chiron said. "And you must have questions for me."
"Only one," Jason admitted. "What did you mean when you said that I should be dead?" Chiron studied him with concern, as if he expected Jason to burst into flames.
"My boy, do you know what those marks on your arm mean? The color of your shirt? Do you remember anything?"
Jason looked at the tattoo on his forearm. S-P-Q-R. The eagle. 12 straight lines. "No," he said. "Nothing."
"Do you know where you are?" Chiron asked. "Do you understand what this place is and who I am?"
"You're Chiron the Centaur," Jason said. "I'm guessing you're the same one from the old stories, who used to train the Greek heroes like Heracles. This is a camp for demigods, children of the Olympian gods."
"So you believe those gods still exist?"
"Yes," Jason said immediately. "I mean, I don't think we should worship them or sacrifice chickens to them or anything,
But they're still around because they're a powerful part of civilization. They move from country to country as the center of power shifts, like they moved from ancient Greece to Rome.
I couldn't have said it better.
Something about Chiron's voice had changed.
So you already know the gods are real. You have already been claimed, haven't you?
Maybe, Jason answered. I'm not really sure. Seymour the leopard snarled. Chiron waited, and Jason realized what had just happened. The centaur had switched to another language, and Jason had understood, automatically answering in the same tongue.
Quis erit?
Jason faltered, then made a conscious effort to speak English. What was that?
You know Latin, Chiron observed.
Most demigods recognize a few phrases, of course. It's in their blood, but not as much as ancient Greek. None can speak Latin fluently without practice.
Jason tried to wrap his mind around what that meant, but too many pieces were missing from his memory. He still had the feeling that he shouldn't be here. It was wrong and dangerous, but at least Chiron wasn't threatening. In fact, the centaur seemed concerned for him, afraid for his safety. The fire reflected in Chiron's eyes, making them dance fretfully.
I taught your namesake, you know, the original Jason. He had a hard path. I've seen many heroes come and go. Occasionally they have happy endings. Mostly they don't. It breaks my heart. Like losing a child each time one of my pupils dies. But you are not like any pupil I've ever taught. Your presence here could be a disaster.
Thanks, Jason said. You must be an inspiring teacher.
I am sorry, my boy, but it's true. I had hoped that after Percy's success...
Percy Jackson, you mean? Annabeth's boyfriend, the one who's missing. Chiron nodded.
I hoped that after he succeeded in the Titan War and saved Mount Olympus, we might have some peace. I might be able to enjoy one final triumph, a happy ending, and perhaps retire quietly. I should have known better. The last chapter approaches, just as it did before. The worst is yet to come.
In the corner, the arcade game made a sad pew-pew-pew-pew sound, like a Pac-Man had just died. Okay, Jason said. So, last chapter. Happened before. Worst yet to come. Sounds fun, but can we go back to the part where I'm supposed to be dead? I don't like that part.
I'm afraid I can't explain, my boy. I swore on the River Styx and on all things sacred that I would never...
Chiron frowned.
But you're here, in violation of the same oath. That too should not be possible. I don't understand. Who would have done such a thing? Who?
Seymour the leopard howled. His mouth froze half open. The arcade game stopped beeping. The fire stopped crackling, its flames hardening like red glass. The masks stared down silently at Jason with their grotesque grape eyes and leafy tongues. Chiron? Jason asked. What's going? The old centaur had frozen too. Jason jumped off the couch, but Chiron kept staring at the same spot, his mouth open mid-sentence. His eyes didn't blink. His chest didn't move.
Jason, a voice said.
For a horrible moment, he thought the leopard had spoken. Then dark mist boiled out of Seymour's mouth, and an even worse thought occurred to Jason. Storm spirits. He grabbed the golden coin from his pocket. With a quick flip, it changed into a sword. The mist took the form of a woman in black robes. Her face was hooded, but her eyes glowed in the darkness. Over her shoulder she wore a goatskin cloak. Jason wasn't sure how he knew it was goatskin, but he recognized it and knew it was important.
"Would you attack your patron?"
the woman chided. Her voice echoed in Jason's head.
"Lower your sword."
"Who are you?" he demanded. "How did you..."
"Our time is limited, Jason. My prison grows stronger by the hour. It took me a full month to gather enough energy to work even the smallest magic through its bonds. I've managed to bring you here. But now I have little time left, and even less power. This may be the last time I can speak to you."
"You're in prison?" Jason decided maybe he wouldn't lower his sword.
"Look, I don't know you, and you're not my patron."
"You know me," she insisted. "I have known you since your birth."
"I don't remember. I don't remember anything."
"No, you don't," she agreed. "That also was necessary. Long ago, your father gave me your life as a gift to placate my anger. He named you Jason after my favorite mortal. You belong to me."
"Whoa," Jason said. "I don't belong to anyone."
"Now is the time to pay your debt," she said. "Find my prison. Free me, or their king will rise from the earth, and I will be destroyed. You will never retrieve your memory."
"Is that a threat? You took my memories?"
"You have until sunset on the solstice, Jason. 4 short days. Do not fail me."
The dark woman dissolved, and the mist curled into the leopard's mouth. Time unfroze. Seymour's howl turned into a cough like he'd sucked in a hairball. The fire crackled to life. The arcade machine beeped, and Chiron said,
"Would dare to bring you here."
"Probably the lady in the mist," Jason offered. Chiron looked up in surprise.
"Weren't you just sitting? Why do you have a sword drawn?"
"I hate to tell you this," Jason said, "but I think your leopard just ate a goddess."
He told Chiron about the frozen-in-time visit, the dark misty figure that disappeared into Seymour's mouth.
"Oh dear," Chiron murmured. "That does explain a lot."
"Then why don't you explain a lot to me?" Jason said. "Please."
Before Chiron could say anything, footsteps reverberated on the porch outside. The front door blew open, and Annabeth and another girl, a redhead, burst in, dragging Piper between them. Piper's head lolled like she was unconscious.
"What happened?"
Jason rushed over.
"What's wrong with her?"
"Here is Kevin,"
Annabeth gasped. Like they'd run all the way.
"Vision. Bad."
The redhead girl looked up and Jason saw that she'd been crying.
"I think," the redhead girl gulped. "I think I may have killed her."
Chapter 8. Jason. Jason and the redhead, who introduced herself as Rachel, put Piper on the couch while Annabeth rushed down the hall to get a med kit. Piper was still breathing, but she wouldn't wake up. She seemed to be in some kind of coma.
"We've got to heal her," Jason insisted. "There's a way, right?"
Seeing her so pale, barely breathing, Jason felt a surge of protectiveness. Maybe he didn't really know her. Maybe she wasn't his girlfriend. But they'd survived the Grand Canyon together. They'd come all this way. He'd left her side for a little while, and this had happened. Chiron put his hand on her forehead and grimaced.
"Her mind is in a fragile state. Rachel, what happened?"
"I wish I knew," she said. "As soon as I got to camp, I had a premonition about Hera's cabin. I went inside. Annabeth and Piper came in while I was there. We talked, and then..." I just blanked out. Annabeth said I spoke in a different voice.
A prophecy? Chiron asked.
No. The spirit of Delphi comes from within. I know how that feels. This was like long distance, a power trying to speak through me. Annabeth ran in with a leather pouch. She knelt next to Piper.
Chiron, what happened back there? I've never seen anything like it. I've heard Rachel's prophecy voice. This was different. She sounded like an older woman. She grabbed Piper's shoulders and told her...
To free her from a prison? Jason guessed. Annabeth stared at him.
How did you know that?
Chiron made a three-finger gesture over his heart, like a ward against evil.
Jason, tell them. Annabeth, the medicine bag, please.
Chiron trickled drops from a medicine vial into Piper's mouth, while Jason explained what had happened when the room froze. The dark, misty woman who had claimed to be Jason's patron. When he was done, no one spoke, which made him more anxious.
So, does this happen often? He asked. Supernatural phone calls from convicts demanding you bust them out of jail?
Your patron, Annabeth said. Not your godly parent?
No, she said patron. She also said my dad had given her my life.
Annabeth frowned.
I've never heard of anything like that before. You said the storm spirit on the skywalk. He claimed to be working for some mistress who was giving him orders, right? Could it be this woman you saw, messing with your mind?
I don't think so, Jason said. If she were my enemy, why would she be asking for my help? She's imprisoned. She's worried about some enemy getting more powerful. Something about a king rising from the earth on the solstice?
Annabeth turned to Chiron.
Not Kronos. Please tell me it's not that.
The centaur looked miserable. He held Piper's wrist, checking her pulse. At last he said,
It is not Kronos. That threat is ended. But...
But what? Annabeth asked.
Chiron closed the medicine bag.
Piper needs rest. We should discuss this later.
Or now, Jason said. Sir, Mr. Chiron, you told me the greatest threat was coming. The last chapter. You can't possibly mean something worse than an army of titans, right?
Oh, Rachel said in a small voice. Oh, dear. The woman was Hera.
Of course. Her cabin, her voice.
She showed herself to Jason at the same moment.
Hera!
Annabeth's snarl was even fiercer than Seymour's.
She took you over? She did this to Piper?
I think Rachel's right, Jason said. The woman did seem like a goddess. And she wore this goatskin cloak. That's a symbol of Juno, isn't it?
It is?
Annabeth scowled.
I've never heard that.
Chiron nodded reluctantly.
Of Juno, Hera's Roman aspect, in her most warlike state. The goatskin cloak was a symbol of the Roman soldier.
So Hera is imprisoned? Rachel asked. Who could do that to the Queen of the Gods?
Annabeth crossed her arms.
Well, whoever they are, maybe we should thank them if they can shut up Hera.
Annabeth, Chiron warned. She is still one of the Olympians. In many ways, she is the glue that holds the gods' family together. If she truly has been imprisoned and is in danger of destruction, this could shake the foundations of the world. It could unravel the stability of Olympus, which is never great even in the best of times. And if Hera has asked Jason for help...
Fine, Annabeth grumbled.
Well, we know Titans can capture a god, right? Atlas captured Artemis a few years ago. And in the old stories, the gods captured each other in traps all the time. But something worse than a Titan?
Jason looked at the leopard's head. Seymour was smacking his lips like the goddess had tasted much better than a snossage. Hera said she'd been trying to break through her prison bonds for a month.
Which is how long Olympus has been closed, Annabeth said. So the gods must know something bad is going on.
But why use her energy to send me here? Jason asked. She wiped my memory, plopped me into the wilderness school field trip, and sent you a dream vision to come pick me up. Why am I so important? Why not just send up an emergency flare to the other gods? Let them know where she is so they bust her out.
The gods need heroes to do their will down here on Earth, Rachel said.
That's right, isn't it? Their fates are always intertwined with demigods.
That's true, Annabeth said. But Jason's got a point. Why him? Why take his memory?
And Piper's involved somehow, Rachel said. Hera sent her the same message. Free me. And Annabeth? This must have something to do with Percy's disappearing.
Annabeth fixed her eyes on Chiron.
Why are you so quiet, Chiron? What is it we are facing?
The old centaur's face looked like it had aged 10 years in a matter of minutes. The lines around his eyes were deeply etched.
My dear, in this, I cannot help you. I am so sorry.
Annabeth blinked.
You've never kept information from me. Even the last great prophecy.
I will be in my office.
His voice was heavy.
I need some time to think before dinner. Rachel, will you watch the girl? Call Argus to bring her to the infirmary, if you'd like. And Annabeth, you should speak with Jason. Tell him about the Greek and Roman gods. But...
The centaur turned his wheelchair and rolled off down the hallway. Annabeth's eyes turned stormy. She muttered something in Greek, and Jason got the feeling it wasn't complimentary toward centaurs.
I'm sorry, Jason said. I think my being here, I don't know. I've messed things up coming to the camp somehow. Chiron said he'd sworn an oath and couldn't talk about it.
What oath? Annabeth demanded. I've never seen him act this way. And why would he tell me to talk to you about the gods?
Her voice trailed off. Apparently she'd just noticed Jason's sword sitting on the coffee table. She touched the blade gingerly, like it might be hot.
Is this gold? She said. Do you remember where you got it?
No. Jason said. Like I said, I don't remember anything.
Annabeth nodded, like she'd just come up with a rather desperate plan.
If Chiron won't help, we'll need to figure things out ourselves, which means... Cabin 15. Rachel, you'll keep an eye on Piper?
Sure, Rachel promised.
Good luck, you two.
Hold on, Jason said. What's in cabin 15?
Annabeth stood.
Maybe a way to get your memory back.
They headed toward a newer wing of cabins in the southwest corner of the green. Some were fancy, with glowing walls or blazing torches, but cabin 15 was not so dramatic. It looked like an old-fashioned prairie house with mud-thatched walls and a rush roof. On the door hung a wreath of crimson flowers, red poppies, Jason thought, though he wasn't sure how he knew.
You think this is my parents' cabin? He asked.
No, Annabeth said. This is the cabin for Hypnos, the god of sleep.
Then why?
You've forgotten everything,
she said. If there's any god who can help us figure out memory loss, it's Hypnos.
Inside, even though it was almost dinner time, three kids were sound asleep under piles of covers. A warm fire crackled in the hearth. Above the mantel hung a tree branch, each twig dripping white liquid into a collection of tin bowls. Jason was tempted to catch a drop on his finger just to see what it was, but he held himself back. Soft violin music played from somewhere. The air smelled like fresh laundry. The cabin was so cozy and peaceful that Jason's eyelids started to feel heavy. A nap sounded like a great idea. He was exhausted. There were plenty of empty beds, all with feather pillows and fresh sheets and fluffy quilts and... Annabeth nudged him.
Snap out of it.
Jason blinked. He realized his knees had been starting to buckle.
Cabin 15 does that to everyone,
Annabeth warned.
If you ask me, this place is even more dangerous than the Ares cabin. At least with Ares, you can learn where the landmines are.
Landmines? She walked up to the nearest snoring kid and shook his shoulder.
Clovis, wake up!
The kid looked like a baby cow. He had a blonde tuft of hair on a wedge-shaped head, with thick features and a thick neck. His body was stocky, but he had spindly little arms like he'd never lifted anything heavier than a pillow.
Clovis!
Annabeth shook harder, then finally knocked on his forehead about 6 times.
What?
Clovis complained, sitting up and squinting. He yawned hugely, and both Annabeth and Jason yawned too.
Stop that, Annabeth said. We need your help.
I was sleeping.
You're always sleeping.
Good night.
Before he could pass out, Annabeth yanked his pillow off the bed.
That's not fair,
Clovis complained meekly.
Give it back.
First, help, Annabeth said. Then, sleep.
Clovis sighed. His breath smelled like warm milk.
Fine.
What?
Annabeth explained about Jason's problem. Every once in a while, she'd snap her fingers under Clovis's nose to keep him awake. Clovis must have been really excited, because when Annabeth was done, he didn't pass out. He actually stood and stretched, then blinked at Jason.
So, you don't remember anything, huh?
Just impressions, Jason said.
Feelings, like...
Yes, Clovis said.
Like, I know I shouldn't be here, at this camp. I'm in danger.
Close your eyes.
Jason glanced at Annabeth, but she nodded reassuringly. Jason was afraid he'd end up snoring in one of the bunks forever, but he closed his eyes. His thoughts became murky, as if he were sinking into a dark lake. The next thing he knew, his eyes snapped open. He was sitting in a chair by the fire. Clovis and Annabeth knelt next to him.
Serious, all right, Clovis was saying. What happened?
Jason said.
How long?
Just a few minutes, Annabeth said. But it was tense. You almost dissolved.
Jason hoped she didn't mean literally, but her expression was solemn.
Usually, Clovis said, memories are lost for a good reason. They sink under the surface like dreams, and with a good sleep, I can bring them back. But this...
Lethe? Annabeth asked.
No, Clovis said. Not even Lethe.
Lethe? Jason asked. Clovis pointed to the tree branch dripping milky drops above the fireplace.
The river Lethe in the underworld. It dissolves your memories, wipes your mind clean permanently. That's the branch of a poplar tree from the underworld, dipped into the Lethe. It's the symbol of my father, Hypnos.
Lethe is not a place you want to go swimming.